We all know the world of energy and natural resources is changing fast. People are demanding action on the climate crisis. Businesses and politicians are throwing their weight behind the energy transition. And technology is reshaping the world as we know it. But we must ensure the result doesn't become too complex and too confusing. That's where the Climate Transition Podcast comes in. In this series, DLA Piper's Energy and Natural Resources team speaks to special guests to help you make sense of it all. My name is Natasha Luther-Jones. I'm the Global Co-Chair of the Energy and Natural Resources sector here at DLA Piper. I'm also co-head of our International Sustainability and ESG offering. And I am your host for the series. Today we ask, what should we expect from COP26? This November, the world's eyes will be on Glasgow. The Scottish city is hosting the United Nations 2021 Climate Change Conference, known as COP26. Politicians at this global gathering will look at how countries can avoid catastrophic climate change. This means working together to mobilise trillions of investment and agreeing common rules which can help the world hit net zero emissions by 2050. It's a huge challenge and also a huge opportunity. In this episode, we're going to discuss what businesses can expect from COP26 and how it will affect the energy transition. What's the best we can expect? What role will the US and China play? How and why has the pandemic pushed climate change up the global agenda? To help answer these, I'm delighted to be joined by Ambassador P. Michael McKinley. Ambassador McKinley previously spent 37 years in the US government, where he was one of the country's most experienced and decorated diplomats. During his career in the US Foreign Service, he held senior positions in countries around the world and was ambassador to Afghanistan, Brazil, Colombia, and Peru. He is now senior counsellor at the Cohen Group. Ambassador McKinley's early assignments in the Foreign Service included the UK, as well as Bolivia, Mozambique, Uganda, and Belgium, in addition to positions at the State Department in Washington. Across these postings, he worked on conflicts in Central America, Southern Africa, and East Africa. Throughout his career, he has worked on many issues related to the interests of businesses working in the multinational environment, including free trade agreements with Peru and Colombia, which included important chapters on environmental and labour issues, the emerging US strategy on Indo-Pacific, and transatlantic trade and investment issues with the EU. In his postings in Africa and Latin America, Ambassador McKinley also promoted programmes to protect the environment. Welcome to our podcast, and wow, what a phenomenal career.
Well, thank you so much, and a real pleasure to be with you today.
So, the title of this podcast is What Can We Expect from COP26? So let's dive straight in. What can we expect from COP26, Ambassador?
The acronym means Conference of Parties, and there is a tremendous amount of attention focused on COP26, which will be held in Glasgow in November this year. Much more so than on previous conferences, but it's important to put a context on the meetings that will take place across 2 weeks in Glasgow. They're part of a process that began in 1995, hence the number 26. They're held yearly. The 1 year meetings were missed was 2020 because of the pandemic, and include all of the signatories to the UN framework on climate change, which was agreed in 1994, and of course of the better known Paris Agreement of 2015. So 197 plus signatories in terms of governments and nations. And also we need to add the constellation of civil society and international and multilateral organizations that will be represented in Glasgow in November. So it's a very significant event. It builds on commitments that have been made over the past almost 30 years regarding climate change. But I think it's fair to suggest there's a new urgency to the discussion. So following on Kyoto Protocol in 1997, the Paris Agreement in 2015, over the last 2, 3, 4 years, there's much greater awareness and global discussion of the challenges posed by climate change. And so Paris laid out the framework for commitments to be made in the coming decades, including a focus on 5-yearly updates on what were called nationally determined contributions by countries regarding their commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and contribute to the goal of limiting global warming. At COP26, what we're hopefully going to see is a more ambitious presentation of targets. This began already with the leadership summit hosted by President Biden virtually in April in Washington this year, in which the United States, for example, almost doubled its commitment and accelerated the pace of its commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the 26 to 28% levels proposed in 2015 to be met by about 2025 to over 50% to be met by 2030. And other countries are following suit. So the objectives, I repeat, are that the NDCs, as the acronym that's used indicate, will include a host of other countries accelerating their own commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There's a real expectation in the wake of the pandemic that wealthier countries will make a much clearer commitment to reaching the $100 billion a year they set as an objective for financial assistance to developing countries at Paris in 2015. It remains to be seen how that will be done, but at the Group of Seven meeting in Carbis Bay in the UK this June, the leading economies of the world, minus China, made a commitment to meeting that objective in November in Glasgow. And that will be a very significant benchmark if there is greater clarity on the kind of financial support that will be offered going forward. There are secondary objectives, which are the expert discussions on tech transfer, new technologies, capacity building, carbon market mechanisms, funding timeframes, what are known as nature-based solutions, which address how to better manage forest, agricultural ecosystem resources. And the metrics there, I think, will be harder to point to in very specific terms. But the fact that they're being delineated in such a clear fashion, and I repeat, in a global context in which people understand much more clearly what the challenge is than they did even in 2015, it gives us hope for a very productive conference. Secretary Kerry, as Special Envoy for Climate for the United States, has stated that COP26 really the last best hope for a great leap forward on commitments. But given what we saw in the Leaders Summit hosted by President Biden, it's pretty clear that there are no climate skeptics anymore, only debates over how to address the challenge we're all facing.
Wow, that's a comprehensive answer, and there's clearly lots on the agenda and lots that we expect and need from governments. I'd quite like to look at it from a slightly different perspective now and delve a bit deeper into how geopolitics, how are they being reshaped by the climate emergency and the energy transition? What's your view on that, Ambassador?
Well, that's a great question, and that's a really difficult question and a controversial one too. So thank you for that. I will first attempt to answer it in a constructive way. Given that since 2015, there's this growing consensus and global understanding on the challenge we're all facing. What we're expecting to see, what we're hoping to see, is greater international cooperation. COP26 in Glasgow, where 30,000 people are going to gather, is certainly a place where the symbolism, as well as the substance of cooperation, should be evident. It will also be clear in terms of how the major donors of the world, the international system, United Nations, cooperate on helping developing countries, vulnerable countries like the Pacific Islands, address the issues. And we'll see if that $100 billion commitment materializes in a manner which allows resources to flow to deal with the issues that are out there. I would envisage, because we're seeing a multiplying of forums for dialogue and cooperation on these issues, that in the coming year and years, there'll be an intensification of discussion and cooperation. One of the things I found most interesting was a declaration at the NATO summit this year, where NATO members, 30 of them, including the United States and our European allies, broke out a special segment of their reviews to commit to a strategy on climate change and climate change action plan, which we really hadn't seen in that form before. People tend to think of NATO as a security alliance focused on interoperability of weapons systems, military exercises, dealing with potential threats, out of area activities, as they're called, in places like Afghanistan and Iraq in the recent past. But they defined climate change as a threat multiplier and one of the defining challenges of our time, and talked about assessments, adaptation, mitigation, outreach. These are all very positive developments. And I already referenced the G7 had pages on the steps they would take to address climate change, reduce consumption of hydrocarbons, speed innovation, and so on. But there's another side to this. And it's going to be the challenge of working in a world that has many different regions, many different approaches to climate change. Developing countries, certainly a country like India or Brazil, see their carbon footprint on a per capita basis as much lower than that of the United States or European countries. And so they will view their approach to meeting the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from the perspective of meeting the needs of their population. In other words, they still need to grow. So there will be tensions in terms of the pace at which they reduce hydrocarbon use. You have the issue of critical minerals. That's a fancy term for minerals which are needed for batteries, for electric vehicles, polysilicon, which is required for building out solar panels. They come from China. They don't just come from China. A significant percentage of polysilicon is produced in Xinjiang, where there's concern about significant human rights abuses. So how do these issues get resolved in a manner that allows supply systems to work and allow the transformation of different industries to move forward? Lithium. Australia produces like 55% of the world's lithium. China produces or consumes a significant part of it. You have a mineral like cobalt, which goes into batteries, as well as lithium. 70% comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So how do you resolve all these questions related to supply base that may come from areas in conflict or areas where there's tensions between different countries around the world. So I would suggest that as we look at this in geopolitical terms, tremendous potential for cooperation, but we should not fool ourselves. There's going to be tensions over how supply chains work, where critical minerals come from, and what kind of cooperation emerges because of the different speeds of economic growth in the developing world and in the developed world going forward.
Again, you've given me loads to go out there, Ambassador, and you've probably actually come up with two future titles for our podcast. I'd love to delve in deeper to the critical minerals issue. And I have to say, being a renewable energy lawyer, the supply chain issues with solar facilities and the necessary due diligence and contractual protections you need is a very hot topic at the moment. So yeah, I think thanks for that. I think you've probably spotted a couple of future episodes for us. Maybe I noticed, so one of the comments you made was geopolitics and the need for collaboration. What sort of role do you think the US will have in that collaboration needed globally?
Well, there's a real debate over whether the United States can reclaim a leadership position on climate change, because people point to the decision by the former administration to withdraw from the Paris Agreement and to international cooperation on addressing the challenges we all face. And so there's concern, and I think it has been evident in the way certain countries in Europe and in the European Union have responded to President Biden's initiatives, that they're welcome, but there's also the question mark of the staying power of what the United States proposes. Should there be a change of administration in subsequent years. I think that's the wrong way to look at this. It is a moment, and accentuated by the impact of the pandemic, in which there has been an extraordinary intensification and acceleration of the focus on climate change and on the efforts to identify resources and policies going forward. And the United States is very much back at the table. And the United States, not only as one of the 3 to 4 top greenhouse gas emitters in the world, but the United States as a source of innovation, as a driver of cooperation, as a potential major contributor to international funding for developing countries addressing climate change issues, all of these lend tremendous importance to the role of the United States in helping work with in an international framework in addressing the challenges going ahead. And I don't think we would have seen as comprehensive statements by the G7 at Carbis Bay, by the NATO summit in Brussels, going forward at the Leaders Summit, which was an initiative of President Biden shortly after entering office, without a clear-cut commitment from the United States. And there's another element, which is resources. However, the infrastructure investment plan is resolved between the U.S. Congress and the U.S. administration. The fact of the matter is, we're talking about trillions of dollars of injection in the coming years in the transformation of the American economy, and with a corollary of a very significant commitment to working internationally through multilateral investment organizations to address change. And so the United States, as an active and vocal and innovative partner in the mix internationally, I think is something that is going to be a very important factor driving forward international cooperation.
Thanks. And I think one of the consequences of the delay, clearly, of a year to COP26 is the US is back at the table, which has got to be a one of the positive consequences of that.
I would suggest that's extremely positive consequence. If COP26 had happened last year, imagine a very different environment in which, at the most important meeting on climate change, since Paris, and certainly the meeting which is going to set the framework and the path for cooperation for the next 10 years, the United States had been absent. We're going to be present, and we're going to be present in force.
It is good to have the US back at the table, and I think it was absolutely needed to look at any of the positive outcomes and the success of COP26. I think the US has to be there, clearly. I'm going to ask you quite a difficult question now to give your view on what you think would represent success for COP26. And although I hate to ask it, you know, what would be a failure? You know, what would mean that COP26 does end up being a flop and a failure?
I'm going to be a typical diplomat or former diplomat and answering that question, because I actually think I've become more optimistic over the past few weeks about the prospects of COP26 being an important gathering that produces results and metrics that can be used going forward. That said, it's very clear that the nations that will attend, everyone's going to be making commitments to climate change. There'll be revisions of the NDCs in terms of meeting greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. Everyone will commit to trying to ensure that global warming does not result in more than a 1.5 degree centigrade increase by the end of the century. But if this is going to be meaningful going forward, it really has to be focused on resources. And it also has to be focused on priorities. What are the most important steps to begin taking going forward? And what are the intermediate and longer term steps that should be addressed? Because the reality is, economies are very different. Population needs are very different. And not every country is going to be able to meet blueprint objectives. They're going to have their own constraints on what they can do going forward and their own timeframes for going forward. So if I could summarize what I do see, first, the most important aspect of COP26 is the symbolism. I do think we're going to see a very different tone to the discussions that take place, a much greater sense of urgency, and frankly, much better communication to the world's population on why it's important to take action going forward. But in terms of measurable results, I do think the financial commitment to helping developing countries, countries that are already vulnerable to climate change, is going to be critical. And it's going to have to be critical in terms of identifying actual amounts coming from key potential donors, whether it's the European Union, the United States, how it will be channeled. Will it be through the World Bank? Will it be through regional development banks? Will it be through bilateral donor agencies that have the capability to build out greater and more urgent cooperation? And certainly, I think there'll be a lot of questions asked if it's simply a recommitment to the figure, as we've seen in the G7 statement, as we saw at the Leaders' Summit, as we saw in Paris 5 years ago. There'll be a lot of questions about whether the commitment is serious if there's not greater specificity on the resources. There also will need, I think, to be a greater sense of prioritization. So the G7 statement placed a great deal of emphasis on a commitment to phase out coal-fired, coal-powered energy, and to accelerate the timetable for shifting to other sources of energy. The fact is that countries like India and China are still building out coal stations and will be until at least 2030 on a significant scale. So how does that priority get translated into action? Is there at least a consensus that's presented on two speeds towards reducing the reduction on coal as a source of energy. I think that's going to be a very important area of discussion. There's going to be a focus on transformations of energy, electricity grids worldwide. We already have discussions in Latin America, in Europe, in East Asia, on what pan-grids can look like across regions and how those can be developed and what kind of investments we can look forward to. There's going to be a focus on a revolution in the transport industry. And I think that's the area where we may see the greatest progress because the discussion on how to move towards electric vehicles is taking on not just urgency, but very practical sort of aspects to include, for example, in the United States, a commitment by the federal government to invest up to $74 billion in the transformation required to have a predominantly electrical vehicle fleet for the nation by 2035 or shortly thereafter. And we're seeing it in other countries as well. On other aspects of climate change, because the milestones can run in the hundreds, if not the thousands, I think we're going to see less, and a lot of it will be a codification or agreement that all of these milestones are important. The technical experts will say we need to do more on this, and there'll be agreement to carry them forward. But I think prioritization along the lines I'm trying to suggest will be extremely important. I think biodiversity is rising up the charts, whether it's worries about the world's oceans, fisheries, deforestation, the changing patterns of weather. We'll see how that gets defined. But I think with what I've tried to outline in my first few comments, if we emerged with symbolism, financial commitments, and a couple of key industries where the transformation is already taking place, that would be a good result. Because remember, COP26 ain't going to be the last meeting. We're looking at hopefully very productive meetings going forward on an annual basis.
Thanks. I agree on the biodiversity point as well. I heard last week that even DLA Piper was considering having bees on our roof in the city of London. But I think it did go through because some health and safety issues of having clients on the balcony with bees around might have put a stop to that. But I definitely agree. Biodiversity does seem to be rising up the agenda across the board now. You mentioned a number of times the sense of urgency, and there's definitely an increased sense of urgency now in relation to COP. It's widely accepted that, you know, that sense of urgency around climate change has increased post-pandemic. What's your view on why that's the case, Ambassador?
That, I think, is the signal development of our times. The pandemic drove home, in a way no other crisis could, the fault lines in international cooperation in responding to a global crisis. And the environmental focus on climate change dovetailed neatly into the challenges we saw as countries and international institutions sought to respond to the health pandemic that we have faced last year and we continue to face this year. And it underscored critical questions regarding supply chain, regarding international cooperation between countries, regarding cooperation within regions, regarding the ability to mobilize financial resources to respond to the needs of the population. It wasn't just the health pandemic we dealt with, and I want to reemphasize, we're still dealing with a health pandemic. But last year, we also dealt with the most severe economic downturn since the 1930s. It appears that it will be short-lived, but it drove home on a scale that was global and drove home to countries that thought that they had thought through all possible responses to economic cycles, how quickly things can change. And as they invested in providing a social safety net for their populations, whether it was subsidies on wages, subsidies to business, rethinking how government finances and services worked, identified the shortcoming in services from education to health to energy provision, there was a realization that there was a need for a great deal more investment in the years to come. In other words, the pandemic couldn't be viewed as a one-off emergency response crisis in which you pour the hundreds of billions of dollars into putting things right, and then you move back to the macroeconomic model you were pursuing before. Virtually every government in the world that has the resources is now undertaking ambitious new spending, which they would not have before the pandemic. We're seeing it in the European Union, $160 billion a year in euros a year for their budget from 2021 to 2027, in which about 30% is going to have to be focused on climate change, innovation, transformation. In the United States, I repeat that Congress and the administration need to work it out, but we're going to see hundreds of billions of dollars in innovation, in infrastructure, and a lot of it focused on the greening of the economy. And so the pandemic helped focus minds. It was a question of how to build a better future for our populations and be better prepared to deal with what used to be called transnational challenges, but which are really existential challenges: pandemics, climate change, the impact of lack of water or changing biodiversity. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that 2020 concentrated minds in a way we may have been waiting 10, 15 years before we saw governments realize the seriousness with which they had to strategize for the future across the board.
You mentioned then the impact of climate change, so the lack of water, lack of biodiversity. How worried do you think we should be about climate change leading to mass displacement of populations and other geopolitical unrest?
The fact of the matter is we already are. And if I can be allowed a parenthetical on my personal experience across my career working in the regions I worked on a lot of conflicts. I worked on a lot of assistance to refugees and displaced populations. And at the time I worked on it, whether I was working on Darfur in Sudan or responding to situations in northern Kenya or Somalia, where I would tend to see them in terms of what people were doing to people. The fact of the matter is, across the last 20 years, we've seen greater stress in responding to the populations, the needs of populations displaced by conflict because of the impact of climate change. You worry about water supplies, the increasing evidence that some of the states that face greatest tension or conflict are affected by drought. In the case of Central America, hurricanes and drought that follows hurricanes. And so we're seeing the experts, whether it's the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the International Committee of the Red Cross, all see a growing trend line in which climate change is increasingly driving and is a part of the displacement of populations within countries and critically across borders. And we're talking about millions of people. And so, again, to bring it a little closer to home, the hurricane impact and drought, droughts that Central America has been experiencing in recent years without question, is seen as one of the drivers for the very heavy migration towards the United States we're seeing now. So it's a really it's a very important concern right now. And it's clear that the international agencies that respond to these crises see the need for greater international governmental awareness of what is happening.
There's clearly a definite link to the humanitarian crisis that many countries and continents experience linked back to climate change. So it's good to hear that governments do need to collaborate and work and think about it in the context of climate change too. Maybe if we take a different tact now and look at more the business response side, so the commercial side, rather than just the governments. There's been a lot in the press about some of the oil majors coming under pressure from their shareholders to go greener. What issues have you seen them facing in the US and elsewhere?
Well, the whole issue of meeting, you know, of corporate governance and has been around, I don't know, 10, 15 years, and has been building across that time. I think the G7 started highlighting it in a very significant way in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, going forward. And the fact of the matter is, what we're seeing is a shift in emphasis and urgency, but it's building on what has been significant transformation in recent years in the importance public subscribe to ESG goals, that corporations subscribe to ESG goals, that financial investors ascribe to ESG goals. And I think, again, in the context of the pandemic, we've seen it crystallize in ever more urgent forms. And so what we can point to, and I'll give some very practical examples of how this has materialized. Deforestation, particularly in Brazil, has attracted the attention of a lot of investors, consumers, media around the world. And across last year and into this year, we've actually seen actions taken, for example, by European investors in June of last year, sending a message to the Brazilian government on the dangers of not continuing programs preventing deforestation in the Amazon. These were managers of almost $4 trillion of assets that were sending that message. Around the same time, agricultural producers, livestock producers in Brazil, and Brazil, after the United States, probably the most important agricultural exporting country in the world, you had a number of European investment funds threatening to divest from their companies if they didn't take a more serious approach to environmental protections for forest cover. In May of this year, to take some British brands, Tesco, Marks and Spencer's, and others, threatened not to buy goods produced in Brazil if the Congress, which was at that time considering a liberalization of protections on vulnerable properties to allow greater agricultural exploitation, if they did not back down on passing that law. So with those examples, I guess what I'm trying to suggest to you is it's a very serious issue, and we're seeing it manifested across the board. I think energy companies are coming under greater pressures to do what they can to accelerate programs they already have in place to address more efficient energy technology, to reduce the footprint of their operations, a focus on stakeholder capitalism. You had BlackRock CEO Larry Fink sending a letter to CEOs, basically suggesting that there will be much more to come in terms of pressures from financial institutions on addressing environmental concerns. And environmental concerns are combined with concerns about human rights, about human capital, capacity building, responsible corporate citizenship. But I think I repeat that many companies are already doing that. But as we look forward, we're looking, for example, at the UN Principles on Investment, which now has 3,000 signatories covering over $100 trillion worth of assets. We have the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures established by the FSB, which establishes some, doesn't establish, but makes very concrete recommendations on how corporations can do more on environment. And shareholders are noticing, as we've seen in a couple of the annual board meetings, which have generated headlines in recent weeks. So it's an idea whose time has come. The foundations were there. The structure and the system and the institutions for dealing with it don't need to be invented now. It's certainly just going to be a question of intensifying and accelerating the application of the rules, probably to include greater influence on regulatory bodies going forward. It was very interesting to see the American Securities and Exchange Commission in March of this year give a lengthy speech on all the steps they're planning to take to address a greater integration of climate change considerations into the criteria they apply more broadly to their responsibilities.
There's certainly been a huge uptick in pressure, whether it's stakeholders, shareholders, or employees. That whole social license to operate really rings true, I think, in the energy and natural resources space. Given the amount of pressure there already has been, and you know, that momentum is building, can we expect to see anything extra coming out of COP in relation to that? Is there going to be more pressure on businesses to react, or is it continuing in the same manner as they are currently?
Again, I think we're in a transformational moment. So, and what we saw with the pandemic concentrating minds, with the pandemic dovetailing with the growing concern about climate change, and with the agenda that's already set for COP26 and the lead up to it, which are set very ambitious targets and objectives, whether it was the Leaders Summit in Washington in April or the G7 declaration in June, I would suggest that COP26 is unlikely to do more than suggest or reinforce messaging that's already coming out. And what will be really critical for companies to look at is how regulators, particularly in developed economies, decide to proceed. So will the European Commission decide to take up some of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures more seriously and make them law? There are already indications that aspects of the recommendations are being factored in to legislation. If I remember correctly, in New Zealand, possibly Canada, if I'm not mistaken, the FSB, the Financial Stabilization Board, very much behind the task force, which it helped create, and looking at upping the ante in terms of the seriousness with which corporations need to look at this. But I would suggest that the pressures are going to come from capital, investors, the public, shareholders. But I'd also like to say it's going to come from the corporations themselves. Corporations are led by people. They're led by visionary leaders. They're composed of, in some cases, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of workers. Climate change is a concern for everyone, and it's an issue that the companies themselves want to address. And in the context of this huge financial commitment we're seeing in Europe, in the European Union, in Canada, the United States, We're seeing commitments in Japan. We're seeing commitments in China, Russia, Brazil, India, South Africa. There is also an unprecedented scale of resources going into transformation of industries and sectors across the board, whether it's transportation at every level, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's cleaner mining, whether it's renewables, and buildings. And so these are all opportunities also for corporations in those different sectors to invest in, take advantage of, and update and modernize what they offer the general public. So I see this as a positive, not a negative. And I also see the companies as largely working with the objectives as opposed to seeing them simply as challenges.
Yeah, you mentioned the huge financial commitment needed, and it's positive. It's not just going to be shouldered by the governments, that everyone's driving forward wanting this transformation. Before we go into looking at, I would quite like to talk to you about the level of commitment you think is needed from governments and whether what we're currently looking at is sufficient. There's a phrase used in the UK all the time by the UK government, which is building back better. Is that a phrase that resonates with you in the US?
It certainly does, because it's used by our new administration as well. And I would suggest it's probably going to become part of the nomenclature of governments around the world. And I don't want to be a skeptic, but I'd rather speak about building forward, because I don't know what we'd be building back to. The transformation that's underway is so significant, of such extraordinary importance for the future of the world, that we're really entering brave new territory. I think the G7 document, it was very interesting. They talked about new frontiers, and they repeated that phrase across their document. And that's exactly where we are right now. And so as you look at what governments are committing, and I repeat, we could go through the figures, but I don't want to be boring on figures. But in Canada, for example, it seems every year there's $15, $17, $20 billion more committed to greening the economy, transformational investments in R&D. France, not dissimilar amount. The United Kingdom, much more. In fact, the United Kingdom seems to be blazing the trail in terms of not just rhetorical commitments, but very active programs on greening the British economy. We're seeing it in Germany with less specificity, but it's there. And in the European Commission, believe me, once they get rolling and start identifying what to do with those tens of billions of extra dollars, they will be doing real investments in new technology and R&D and supporting sectors and sectors of economies in some of their member states to move forward the transformation. And as I pointed out, the United States setting the standard in terms of ambition. I hope that as compromises get worked out, we're going to see significant amounts of money being spent very shortly in the United States as well. So I'm bullish on governments moving forward on this. I live to be proved wrong, but hopefully not for a few years. I think there's a real commitment that has developed.
That's clearly positive. Do you think it's enough, though? And also, is it sustainable in itself?
It's not enough. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable for the reasons more orthodox economists are pointing out around the world, which is you can't continually build up deficits and get away with it. You have to pay for it at some point. And we're seeing very significant rises in debt to GDP ratios in many countries on the order of 8, 10, 15% in 1 year. And the anticipation was it would come down quickly with economic growth recovering and governments returning to more orthodox management of their nation's budgets. That's not happening for the reasons we've discussed. There needs to be an investment in transformation now. The pandemic has made clear how many fault lines exist in so many societies, and there's a greater urgency and understanding of what meeting climate change will require in terms of economic transformation. But there is a limit, and deficit spending can't continue at the levels it has, and there's going to have to be certainly a rethink of how that spending is approached. So that's where financial markets come into play. That's where corporations' own investments come into play. That's where consumer decisions come into play in terms of what they choose to buy and how they choose to change what they do going forward. And we're talking about trillions of dollars in private equity markets that can be invested in this transformation over a many years timeframe. We are talking about corporations looking at how they prepare themselves for a different kind of economy over the next 20 to 30 years. And we also look at consumers that help drive change with their changing priorities on demand and spending. So I do think there'll be very significant resources available from a number of sources. The bottom line on this, however, it requires economic growth to continue. A shock to the system in which growth were to slow on a significant scale would have a significant delay impact on greening economies going forward.
So that's quite a balanced view, and it leads me up to my last question, and it's a question I like to ask all my guests on the podcast. Are you hopeful for the future?
I'm hesitating because
you are.
I don't want to be Pollyannish. I think the moment we're living, and this has been made clear by the responses of governments that we've seen, by the tremendous work influence that activists, scientists, everybody who works on climate change and has been for the past decades, the impact they've had on making clear just what the scale of challenge we're facing is. It does require not just the whole of government, whole of society. It's a global response going forward. As I said earlier, there's different speeds on responding between the developing world and the developed world. There are different approaches with top-down, which I would suggest European governments are more comfortable with, and more of a focus on private sector-led, which is something the United States would be more comfortable with. There's debates over whether carbon sequestration policies are the right approach. There's debates over whether there ought to be punitive policies towards hydrocarbon producers, even though the world is not anticipated to lessen, in absolute terms, its use of hydrocarbons until the 2035-2040 period. In other words, there's debate over whether renewables can fill the gap left by the rush to cleaner energy sources. And I would suggest, despite our discussion of the tremendous resources being devoted to this issue, almost any review you look at suggests that the amounts being committed now are still woefully insufficient for the challenge of meeting net zero emissions objective in 2050, let alone limiting the warming of the globe to 1.5 degrees centigrade by 2100. There's the suggestions that we need double and triple the investment levels that are already being proposed to meet the energy targets that are being set. And I don't see an easy answer to where that funding is going to come from, or because in governments change and the world changes and there's always unexpected events that throw us off course. I see it as we ought to be a little harder eyed about how fast we think we can go. I do think it's important to set the ambition. COP26 will reaffirm it. countries and governments will individually work towards it. But at the end of the day, it's a race against time, and we don't have that much time to meet the challenge we're facing. So I would prefer to look at this in terms of metrics that can be measured. We're going to have some coming up by 2030, and that certainly will be a date at which it will be clear whether there's meaningful changes underway. I don't want to end on a negative note. That everything that has developed over the past 18 months, this is truly a transformation of the debate on climate change, on government and private sector resource commitments, on identifying a multiplicity of layers, sectors to work in. There's tremendous opportunities for international cooperation. All of that's going to be reaffirmed at COP26. And in the coming few years, very few years, we'll have to see concrete actions to demonstrate that we have a reasonable chance of meeting the objectives we've set for ourselves. And those start being measured very concretely by 2030, 2035.
Thank you for that. That's a very objective and balanced response to, I suppose, what's a very subjective question. I think you can tell you're a politician. You're the only politician I've had on the podcast. Everyone else has been very subjectively optimistic. But look, thank you so much for your time, Ambassador McKinley. It's been an absolute pleasure and some really fascinating insights.
Well, I'm really sorry that I won't be in Glasgow in November, not unless I get an invitation at some point. I'm no longer in government, and but we'll be following it very closely. And as a person who has spent time in Glasgow, very much enjoyed the city, and it's a great place for the symbolism that COP26 represents. And looking forward to what will be a very productive 2 weeks for the world.
Thank you. I have to say, we at DLA Piper are optimistic about COP26. We know when we see the politicians and businesses take a lot of flack if they don't take action. So I think we're justified in our optimism. I think also the Paris Agreement has given us hope. It does show that it's possible to achieve global agreement and spark investment from companies. So, we'll have to have a chat and we can discuss the outcomes of COP26 again, Ambassador McKinley.
Well, thank you so much for having me with you today. And I very much enjoyed it. I think this is a topic which we could speak about for days begin to really dig into the details of how we move forward. But the top lines are important enough for COP26, and hopefully we're going to get some of the hard resources we need for all of us to move forward. So thank you again.
Thanks. That just leaves me now to say thank you all for listening, and please catch us again next time when we'll be asking, will oil giants supercharge the transition? Please subscribe to the series at dlapiper.com/ENR or via your usual podcast platform.